This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Helen Lewis, and this is Start the Week from BBC Radio 4. I hope you enjoy the show. Just 1 week after the war in Europe ended in 1945, the economist John Maynard Keynes warned that Britain faced a financial Dunkirk. Despite the strains on the public purse, though, the next 6 years saw the creation of a National Health Service, the first Universal Family Allowances Act, and the building of a million new homes. Britain faces a similar financial black hole today after the impact of the pandemic. Tax rises are already scheduled for the spring. But the pandemic also revealed the collective spirit of Britain. The historian and crossbench peer Peter Hennessy believes it's changed the country. His new book, Duty of Care, says we will one day divide politics into two eras, before COVID and after COVID. Jane Allison is the curator of a new exhibition at the Barbican exploring post-war art. This wasn't just a time of political change, but creative renewal too, she argues. And Farhan Samanani is an anthropologist joining us from Germany, whose field study in a diverse North London neighbourhood hopes to answer one simple question. How can we live with those who are different to us? Peter, hello, let me start with you first.
Morning.
Good morning. The post-war settlement is one of those phrases that gets bandied around a lot, but can you tell me what actually was it?
It was a bundle of measures which essentially were the implementation of the Beveridge Report of 1942. And Sir William Beveridge, a great social statistician, had been given the job of tidying up the national insurance system insofar as we had one. It was a patchwork. And he turned it into a crusade in which there were five giants on the road to recovery: ignorance, idleness, squalor, disease and want. And his argument in essence was, unless you struck those five giants simultaneously, the outer crust of deprivation would not yield. And it was the first and last big strategic look at welfare and economy and political economy that we've had as a nation. And I've often wondered why we've not had one since. And out of it came this fistful of crucial measures of national insurance and, above all, the creation of a National Health Service in 1948, for which there was a very high level of political consensus between the parties. There were tremendous political rows after the war, but they were mainly about nationalisation. But the shared experience of being in the home front and on the battlefronts in the Second World War had A, concentrated minds, and B, shown what the state could do if it mobilised its resources in a collective way. And we lived off the hump of that virtue and that analysis, that intellectual R&D, if you like, for the first 20 to 30 years after the war. And my argument, I suppose, in the book is quite simple, that COVID experience is not comparable to a total war. Of course it isn't. But it's the first time since 45 we've all been in a shared experience that we could not ignore. You could not privatise yourself away from the COVID experience. It was one of those, we went to bed every night with a kind of dashboard of statistics in our minds, as well as anxieties about family and friends. And it brought out a level of altruism in us that we hadn't seen, I think, since the 1940s.
Well, let me go back, because there's a lot to unpack here. First of all, I want to hear a bit more about William Beveridge. Who was this guy who came out of nowhere? I mean, he wasn't part of the government, or was he? Was he freelancing with the Beveridge Report?
Well, he was an academic who was brought into the service of the state, just as John Maynard Keynes was, who you mentioned a moment ago. And he'd been of great use to the Lloyd George coalition in the Great War and was brought back for the Second World War. But he was an extremely difficult man to deal with. He was vain and prickly. And the great Ernest Bevin, the great incarnation of the Labour movement, who was Minister of Labour, said, "Find this man a job to get him out of my hair so that we won't hear from him again for the duration of the war." And Beveridge was put onto this monumentally complicated task, but largely through his own gifts for self-publicity, as well as the mood of the country changing very much under the shared deprivation of the bombs and rationing and so on, he turned it into a crusade. And I think the Labour Party won the 1945 general election when, in the parliamentary debate on the Beveridge Report in early 43, the Labour members who were not in the coalition rebelled against the coalition and voted for a full implementation of Beveridge. The coalition wanted to do it in stages. So it was going for the full Beveridge that I think won Labour its huge majority in 1945. But we must never forget that the Conservative opposition in the late 40s was fully in favour of most, though not all, of the Beveridge provisions. They would have done some of it more slowly, more frugally in terms of public money. But the level of consensus was very high indeed. And the spirit of the people, though everybody was exhausted and worn out, and we'll come on to the bomb sites later on in the programme. Though everybody was worn out, they had a spirit of optimism and shared purpose, which I think, I do hope we've rediscovered. I think we have.
I just want to pick you up on that idea about war changing everything. I think this week has been a very good example of that, or the last week or so, where you have Germany cutting off the Nord Stream pipeline plans, for example, or, you know, rewriting its defence policy, really, over the last several decades. I think about the First World War and the fact that without that, it's hard to see how you get universal suffrage on the timeline that we did have it. Wars are this moment where everything in politics is up for grabs in a way.
I think there's a lot in that, Helen. And you'll remember the great socialist historian Arthur Marwick, who wrote about a very good book called Britain in the Century of Total War. And he had this wonderful line, did Arthur, which was, wars are like weddings, essentially extravagant and unnecessary, but a great stimulus in a convention-bound society. And in a funny way, they speed up historical processes. A lot of the thinking that went into the making of that post-war settlement had been done in the 20s and 30s. But it took Hitler, as it were, to force us to reform ourselves with such a level of intensity and purpose, just as it's taken a pandemic to get us to concentrate on the essentials of life to the extent that we now are.
Well, the other thing that strikes me as an echo between these two periods is money. So we had 11 million people using the furlough scheme. We gave out more than a billion free COVID tests at a cost of about £2 billion a month at its height. After the Second World War, we had the Americans to bail us out. We don't, unfortunately, I think, this time. How do we pay for something on this scale?
Well, it's going to take quite a long time. When I was preparing the book, I got a friend of mine, Nick McPherson, who used to be Permanent Secretary to the Treasury for quite a long time, to do an assessment for me of what the cost of this has been so far. And he reckoned it's about a fifth of the cost of a total war. And it will take a lot of recovering from. The infrastructure of the state is intact. We haven't lost the bombing, the destruction of the houses and the infrastructure that we had, of course, in the Second World War. But it's going to take a lot of recovering from. It's going to take a lot of productive activity and a high level of sustained growth for many decades to come. And one of the big questions is, can we raise productivity in the coming years, using the benefits of artificial intelligence to break through that productivity problem we've had since the end of the Second World War? We're so much better off per capita than we were in the late 40s, of course we are, but compared to our main economic competitors, we've had a very sluggish rate of productivity, and we need to crack that problem as well as all the other ones that we might talk about in terms of post-COVID Britain.
Well, let's come on to AI and the other things that are very different now in a moment, but first of all, I'm going to come to Jane, because I think this extraordinary moment post-war is obviously what your exhibition is all about. But in art, what characterises that period? What's different from before?
Right. Well, I think it was the very conditions of war that created the new. It seemed to me that this just hasn't been looked at properly. The impact of the war, how would artists respond to loss, grief, displacement, and anxiety? So much anxiety on so many fronts. And what happens when there is a failure of ideologies to prevent the cataclysm that had occurred? And art tells us, it reveals it to us. I think the work in the post-war period was utterly different to what had preceded it.
One of the things I picked up, your catalogue opens with an image that I love and I find astonishing and incredibly moving even now, which is Lee Miller, the photographer, in Hitler's bathtub. And the boots that she's got in front of her, still have the mud of Dachau, of the concentration camp, on them. And it is a period that artists had to confront horror. And again, the sense that things that maybe people didn't believe could happen had happened, and that news coming out of Europe must have profoundly influenced some of the things that we see in that period.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the Miller photograph is incredible, and I position it at the beginning of the exhibition as, one of the first pieces of, really audacious, incredible work by a woman artist. And there she is, as you say, in Hitler's bath, staging herself. I mean, what a brave thing to do. And there were shockwaves. I mean, there were shockwaves and everywhere. And the loss was, beyond imagination, I think, for people to deal with. And artists had to respond to that. I mean, they had to find meaning. They had to heal. They had to connect. they were, you know, art was a way of living, of you know, finding their own agency, of you know, in an entirely altered world.
So let's talk about a couple of the specific artists, because you have got some of the big beasts in this exhibition. You have some early Lucian Freud paintings, you have some Francis Bacon paintings. Those artists who would go on to become household names, what characterises their work of the period?
Well, I mean, quintessential post-war artists would be somebody like Frank Auerbach, for instance. I mean, we have a room, a wonderful room of Frank Auerbach's work alongside Leon Kossoff and Gustav Metzger.
So Frank Auerbach was a Jewish refugee from Nazi Germany who then moved to England. So he brought that particular experience with
exactly,
him.
Exactly. And, you know, it's an incredibly moving room of work that just speaks so much of their experience and how, you know, I don't think that is given the attention that it deserves. I mean, a painting like The Head of Gerda Bohm, for instance, from 1964, you know, her flesh is like a lunar landscape, a galaxy of stars. It's totally bewitching painting in which Auerbach layers on the paint so that we're looking at this terrain that's being explored. It has such a vital spirit and internal geometry. It's fluid and yet it has architectonic control. And there's this, you know, need to be close to their subject in order to a sort of intimacy, a desire to connect with the subject, and you know the pain of the period, the loss of the period reveals itself through the painting.
And does the geography in which these artists, the physical space in which these artists were working, can you see that too? I mean, these were people often working in cities which had become bomb sites, you know, the outside world was intruding on them.
Yeah, I mean, I say in the exhibition and in the book that the bomb site was an ever-present reality, and it was for artists both a hunting ground and a canvas, and it was also the location for, you know, children and playing. It became an adventure playground, but it was also this sort of gaping hole in the terrain of Britain, which you know was of course the exhibition is being staged at the Barbican, which came out of a bomb site. But yes, I mean I think it's very telling. I mean, for me, the bomb site and the survivor body are the two kind of most emblematic kind of subjects or symbols for this post-war period.
That's interesting, because I think Bacon, being an artist that maybe listeners will be more familiar with, was somebody who did distort the body in often quite grotesque ways. And do you see that as partly a political gesture?
I think, you know, that for Bacon, it was all about deepening the mystery. It was about the body, but the body was absolutely the site of, you know, it was where everything happened. I mean, it was all about making internal sensation evident in the body, and finding this sort of hinterland between figuration and abstraction. And we have these three incredible paintings by Bacon in the show, from the Man in Blue series. I'm not sure that this has ever been, you know, that we've ever brought for a very long time that these three paintings have been brought together, of a lone man in a bar. So there's this sort of sense of existential aloneness about the paintings, and an incredibly contemporary feel to them as well.
And they're on a very dark ground, aren't they, with a sort of single figure in the middle and then that very classic Bacon geometry around him in order to suggest, as you say, a bar, but also kind of a cage, I always feel when I look at those Bacon paintings.
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, of course, Bacon was very familiar with the photographs that were coming out of the, you know, the trials in Germany and that sort of sense of aloneness. And but yes, those paintings, though, that essentially the faces emit light and they are, you know, are they a generic lone man in a bar? Are they a projection of Bacon himself? Were they his lover, Peter Lacy? I mean, but you know, they're just haunting, actually.
They contain immense ambiguity, which I think I feel as well is a hallmark of much of this art is that it does have, it does invite the viewer in to complete the final, you know. I know you write in the catalogue that we shouldn't get into arguments about abstract art versus figurative art in this period, but someone who, as I understand it, did do more figurative art was an artist I hadn't heard of, Eva Frankfurther, who studied alongside Frank Auerbach. Now, this is a tragic story, her story, but also in her short life, she created some extraordinary works. Perhaps tell me a little bit more about them.
Yes, she was you know, she's been entirely marginalised as an artist and is little known. And we, you know, have this wonderful room of her work alongside photographs by Shirley Baker. But yes, she came as before the war, escaping from Nazism. She was intent on really painting her fellow workers at Lyons Coffee House, where she worked nights as a counter hand and a pot cleaner, and also the other migrant communities that she lived alongside in Whitechapel. I mean, she sadly took her own life in her late 20s. But the works are full of compassion, and you know, she imbues these wonderful scenes of women taking a rest break, you know, with great dignity, and she's a wonderful colourist as well.
And you've shown her alongside Shirley Baker, is another name that I wasn't until now familiar with, who photographed working class life. What does the juxtaposition of the two of them give the viewer?
I think it's about, I think I said that, you know, the show is about multiple modernisms. So we don't make this distinction between, you know, so much interesting work happened across figuration and abstraction, photography, painting, sculpture. But you know, they were both very sensitive colourists. They're both, you know, mapping, evidencing working class life, you know, amongst dereliction of Britain, you know, without sentiment as well. I mean, and bringing this dignity that I was talking about a minute ago to the work, and so it's very reflective. It's very beautiful, but putting, you know, real human experience at the heart of the work.
One of the things that speaks to what Furhan's book is about, that this issue, that this exhibition also addresses the changing face, literally, of post-war Britain, in the sense of both Jewish refugees arriving from Germany and the continent, but also artists from, I think you put it, call it in the catalogue, the crumbling empire. Mm-hmm. So Frank Bowling, Dennis Williams from Guyana, and then Francis Newton Souza from India. Tell me a bit about what their experience was, because was it an experience of crushed optimism, of optimism that then moved to disillusion in many cases?
In some respects, yes. They came with great hope and optimism. Stuart Hall called them the first wave that came wanting to own modernism, wanting to participate in, you know, the nascent scene in Britain at that time. But of course, when they arrived, they experienced racism. They were very aware of that. They were also aware of the colonial oppression from you know, Souza had been very active in India before he arrived, in terms of, you know, protesting against colonial Britain in India. But when they came, yes, you know, Aubrey Williams talked about how he experienced, you know, people touching him in bars as a sign, you know, that it was meant to be good luck to touch a black man in a bar. And so they struggled to some extent to.
And then through the Commonwealth Immigration Acts, presumably, which then ran on through the 60s and onwards in an attempt to sort of redefine Britishness, to exclude the former Commonwealth, presumably. That brings me to, I think, a good time to bring in Peter, because you've seen the catalogue, the show opens this week. Did it make you see anything you've written about in a different light?
It's so full of riches, Jane's catalogue. I can't praise it enough, really. There's a lovely phrase in there about the spangled enchantment of survival, which will resonate with me for a very long time, but also as Jane was just explaining, and it's the two streams that so enriched our artistic life as a country after the war, the refugees from Nazism and fascism, plus the, as you might put it, the empire coming home, two amazing streams. But also it led to a flowering of a tradition that was already quite well established before the war, I think, in terms of photo documentary, which particularly speaks to me as a post-war historian. Bert Hardy, the great Bert Hardy of Picture Post, his pictures of Birmingham bomb sites in 51, and Roger Main's Bermondsey Children in a Bomb-Wrecked Tenement, 56. Now, that does resonate with me because I'm nearly 75 now, so those bomb sites in North London where I was growing up were my adventure playground too, and that will speak to me forever, those photographs. But it's the cornucopic richness of this exhibition that's almost overwhelming, really, and there's so much to draw from it, and it's beautifully produced.
Well, I'd like to put the same question really to you, Farhan. Was there anything in this that made you think your work was in Kilburn in northwest London? Did it make you reconsider anything that you had written or thought about?
I think for me, something that I found really striking sort of across the catalogue were, you know, there's these two themes sort of within post-war art, but post-war thinking and life more generally, which was sort of, you know, the potential of the future and then the sort of horror of the past. But how for so many people living through that post-war moment, those sort of weren't opposing themes that you found at different moments of life, but they were really sort of woven together, you know, that there was a sense of we need to rebuild or else it could go quite wrong. You know, that there was sort of rebuilding wasn't just a sort of process of optimism, but it was sort of trying to contain this sort of horror. And I think you see that sort of in people's daily struggles, you know, that at least in my sense, I've tried to tell quite an optimistic story and look at, you know, people who have all these sorts of great tools for connecting and coming together across lines of difference. But some of that optimism comes from this place of, you know, people having faced the darknesses of racism and exclusion and, you know, really knowing what's at stake if they don't find those tools.
Well, Peter, that is a good moment to come back to your book, A Duty of Care, because you are making an optimistic argument. You do believe that the after COVID era can be one of great political renewal. So tell me what you think should characterise the post-COVID era.
I think a consensus is there for the taking, really. We would all have different ingredients, but I've got five things where I think this consensus is pretty well manifest already. If we can find a political class to find the tone, can manage the tone and pitch of language and the imagination to make it happen in a very consensual way. One is social care. We now know more than we've ever known before about the needs of social care because of the way the pandemic ripped through the old people's homes. We need a private-public push, a very big one on social housing. We need to get technical education right for the first time ever. We've been trying since the mid-19th century to get this right, to be able to pay for all this. And that links to the point that we were touching on a moment ago about artificial intelligence, the fourth industrial revolution. If we don't humanise that as it happens, it's going to wipe out a vast number of jobs and immiserate large sections of the existing workforce. And finally, climate change, the mitigation and combating of it. Now, I think that quintet is something around which we could coalesce. And that together, if we could do it, we'd be called what an American economic historian called about those post-war years of economic boom. They would be pessimism breakers. We could get used to working together again as a country, looking for things to fall in about rather than to fall out over.
OK, well, let me be your the pessimism monger who needs to be broken on this one, because one of the things that strikes me about let's take social care first, is we do have an ageing population. The percentage of state spending that is needed to maintain our both pensions commitment and social care commitment is going to grow relative to the amount of workers paying taxes to fund that. So that is a profound challenge, isn't it?
It is indeed, which is why we have to have that productivity breakthrough to pay for it. And the link, I think, actually, Helen, between the first period I look at in the book and the second is that a social care service, as you might call it, would be the completion of those post-war reforms. It would sit alongside the National Health Service. And indeed, that is the plan, roughly speaking, for it to do that. So there's a symmetry there. But I do think it is there for the taking. One of the problems, however, is that Brexit turned us so nasty on each other. It's soured our politics. Our politics is full of rancour. But if I was trying to persuade a politician, I'm not a politician, I'm a crossbencher, I don't have any party politics at all. You get a very small window usually if you're a politician. Do you want the 2020s to be a period of further recrimination and narrowness, narrow gauge politics, bitter politics, or do you want it to be the basis of a very highly productive decade for our children and our grandchildren.
Well, on that basis, I've got another bucket of water that I want to pour
on
you here.
Have a go. Pour away.
Again, to come back to elderly care, you know, when Andy Burnham put social care reform plans up, they were called a death tax. When Theresa May tried the same thing, it was called a dementia tax. There is an enormous benefit to be reaped by any party who isn't the one proposing them to kind of go, this is very scary, you should be against this.
You're spot on, Helen, which is why I said a moment ago we need a political class that can get broad gauge again and rise above the narrow short-term partisan advantage for labelling these things that need to be done in that crude way. And unless we find the tone of language, of content of political language and pitch, it won't happen. But it is there for the taking. Do they want to be part of a political generation that underperformed, that was meagre, that didn't rise to the level of events? Or do they want to provide a proper memorial to the fallen of COVID, which would be a permanent improvement in our society and the way we get on with each other and how, indeed, how we live with each other, which is Farhan's thesis too. And that's another optimistic book, so I know I've got an ally in my new friend Farhan.
Well, OK, for next bucket of water, which is that trust in the government is quite low after, whatever you want to call it, Partygate, after Barnard Castle. This is a government that has had some pretty serious knocks in terms of whether or not it's walking the walk in terms of the things it's proposing. You know, what needs to change in order to get that high level of trust back?
I think good politics would be decent politics. It seems a long time ago now, but the North Shropshire by-election in late November or early December, whenever it was, showed that we're still shockable as a nation. We don't shrug our shoulders and say, well, the politicians are dodgy, that's the way they are, let's get on with life. We're still shockable. We want them to be better than they are.
This is the one that was lost by the Conservatives by a pretty whacking great margin, unusual for a by-election. Right.
Absolutely. We want our political class to rise to the level of events and not be narrow partisan and crude. And that this sounds terribly pompous, and all sorts of people will think, what a pompous old bastard Hennessy is.
But I apologise for your language for the sensitive Radio 4 listeners. But yes.
I'm so sorry. If I can't rant in my old age, when can I rant? We need a political class that rises to the level of events, that's worthy of the people of this country who showed such magnificent solidarity over the 2 years of the COVID experience. And I think it's there for the taking. I really do. If only we can break through that crust of pessimism and stop labelling each other's better efforts as dementia tax or and so on, as you describe.
Farhan, I think Peter has extended a hand of friendship to you. You want to come in on that?
Well, yeah, because I think it's definitely, you know, a reorientation in the political class is needed. But I think the other challenge is we sort of need to find a way to re-embed politics within everyday life. And the thing about COVID and, you know, the post-war moment was that it sort of did that whether you liked it or not. You know, suddenly you realized getting out, doing your grocery shopping, seeing your nan, all of these things were profoundly political. You know, in the post-war moment, you know, the right to go to school, healthcare, all these kind of ordinary things that we can so easily take for granted, you know, communities coming together, even just socializing. We saw sort of, you know, that they had to be supported by a certain social infrastructure. But well-working infrastructure, when it works well, it fades into the background. We forget that we sort of live profoundly political lives. And so I think the other side of that disenchantment is not just with the politicians, but it's actually with the sort of level of remove that we've come to feel. And part of that is, you know, because things sometimes do work well, but part of it's also because we've stripped away some of that social infrastructure, you know, some of those inns where people can come to become involved in their communities,
Let's come back to that, because that's the theme you... But I agree with you. I think sometimes if you went back to 1500 and said, I've got a tap in my house through which water that will not kill me emerges any time of the day or night, people think this was close to miraculous. But now it seems... No one gets up in the morning and thanks the Lord for their taps. Jane, I just want to get a sense from you about whether or not you think... Is this a fertile period now, post-COVID, for artists? Is there interesting post-COVID art and architecture happening already?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, crisis creates. I think Peter said this. I mean, the conditions in which artists have to respond and find meaning and experiment. And so we have a wonderful artist, Abbas Sahedi, who is an associate artist to the exhibition, who is setting up this project, The Age of Many Posts, and inviting artists into respond to the exhibition.
What are the posts that he's talking? Postal service post,
post Brexit, post everything, and now of course we have, you know, the horrendous situation in Ukraine, obviously, you know, which has made the exhibition and artists think so, you know, so profound, so profoundly
one of the things I think I've noticed is that there is already within the imagery that is coming out of Ukraine a kind of commentary on that image. War photography has always been a very contested subject, and we now live in such a media saturated coverage. I'd wonder if there is an image from Ukraine that has come out that you think has been as moving as that image of Lee Miller in the bathtub. I mean, we're only 4 days in, so perhaps not.
Not that I've seen, to be honest. And forgive me, I've been very focused on, you know, rather than watching the news, I've been listening to it on the radio. But I'm sure there will be powerful images.
Mm. Well, let me bring in Farhan Samanani and How to Live with Each Other. So an anthropologist notes on sharing a divided world. You know, it's clear from the Barbican's exhibition that, you know, there lots of the photos and work in there does focus on a much more multicultural Britain than we're used to thinking of in that post-war period. But you have specifically been to an incredibly diverse part of London, northwest London, Kilburn. Tell me, what attracted you as a place to do anthropological research?
Well, I think anthropology is this sort of discipline that's, you know, grounded in learning from human difference. But the way that's so often done is people sort of try to juxtapose the West and the rest. You know, so they go off classically to places like Papua New Guinea or to sort of, you know, more remote communities within sub-Saharan Africa or something like that. And they say, these people are not like us. And that, you know, that also sort of reveals our own kind of contingency, the own ways in which we're sort of a product of history and certain social decisions and politics and so on. But actually, you know, especially within the modern world, you can do that sort of comparison right on your doorstep. And I think there's actually so much more to be gained from sort of, you know, looking inwards in some of these ways and saying, you know, what are sort of the kind of social struggles and different perspectives and different views of community or society or diversity and being together that sort of coalesce and contest on our own doorstep.
You've got this wonderful quote from Zadie Smith, which talks about the languages on Kilburn High Street and, you know, the fact that there's a mosque opposite a pub and all of that kind of stuff jumbled up together. So it does seem to be a place where you can follow lots of the strands of British post-war to present life.
Mm, that's absolutely right. And I think the other thing, so I've got a second quote from Zadie Smith that I absolutely love, where she sort of talks about, you know, well, why Kilburn, right? And she says, increasingly, because her novels often do incorporate this element of conflict, and sometimes like conflicts between people from different backgrounds. And so she gets asked, you know, are you telling us that the multicultural experiment has failed? And, you know, she says, as a child, I didn't realize that the life I was living was considered in any way provisional or experimental by others. I thought it was just life. You know, and it's sort of that element of just life that I think makes Kilburn really compelling.
One of the things you bring out, which is a thorny topic, is the idea of different waves of migration and the fact that as migrants sort of move back in, you know, and become more established, they might actually sometimes have prejudiced views or concerns about newer migrants, right? That they see them, that there is an us and them that develops even within communities that are otherwise very mixed. So you have a second generation Asian British man who says he would have voted UKIP because he's worried about immigration.
Right. Yeah. And he's sort of, you know, he's sort of half tongue in cheek, but half serious when he's saying all of this. But it's interesting because I don't think any of those processes are inevitable. But, you know, the reason he sort of gives this kind of has this sort of rant about, you know, oh, migrants these days, you know, you don't know what they're up to. They don't want to be part of the community is because, you know, quite genuinely, he's not being given the sort of tools to connect. And so it is kind of, again, about that social infrastructure. You know, I used this guy in my book, he's sort of anonymized as Imran, as this really interesting example, because he also runs this community center in Kilburn that was, you know, sort of kind of for young Muslims, but tremendously welcoming and open and sort of non-denominational and Muslim sort of oriented stuff, but really just open to the broader community as well. And so he has this ethos of openness that he's very good at sort of playing out in certain spheres of his life. And then when he sort of lacks the means to connect with others, suddenly the walls go up. And so both those sorts of things are possible and really depends on, you know, the sorts of supports that we're providing more generally.
And can you tell me a bit more about Paddy and Daisy, who are two of my favorite characters from the book?
Yeah. So they're I think, the first kind of stories that I open with. And they're great. I really, really enjoyed getting to know them. They're sort of the best of friends. they're both sort of in their older age, but there's still a, you know, 15-year gap between them or something, because Daisy's in her mid-90s at the time. Daisy was in her mid-90s at the time I was doing this work, and Patty in his sort of late 70s. And, you know, the two of them are sort of both migrants of a sort. So Daisy's come from kind of rural England and Patty from Ireland, come to London, had this sort of classically kind of dislocating experience of being all alone in the big city. And what they do is they sort of, you know, in the social housing in which they're living, they sort of form a residence association. And they, it becomes this sort of surrogate family for people from really all over the world, you know, Pakistan, Eastern Europe. And they really sort of form this close-knit group of neighbors. And then sort of, you know, fast forward to the present day, and you can kind of catch, you know, Patty ranting about sort of all, you know, all the corrosive things that he believes immigration is doing to the country. And then you challenge him and you say, you know, what about these people you were close with? Or, you know, in my case, because we grew quite close, you know, Daisy goes, what about him? He's an immigrant, you know, I mean, you can hear it in my voice. And Patty goes like, oh, not like him. Of course I don't, you know, of course I don't mean those people. And it's just, again, you know, I think this really striking illustration that, you know, he's quite sincere. It's not an excuse, you know, it's not an I'm not racist, but he's quite sincere. You know, I really do care for certain people. He does have a certain aptitude to connecting across difference, and yet he doesn't have all the tools to sort of extend that, you know, unlimitedly. And that's partly a matter of not having the right stories, but it's partly, again, a matter of that day-to-day infrastructure.
Well, Peter, I wanted to bring you in this, because one of the things that in Farhan's telling of Paddy and Daisy's story, they run this sort of residence association. They help out people in their block of flats, but they become overwhelmed by it because the churn of people becomes too much. And actually, the state is offering such minimal support that people turn to Paddy and Daisy, who are in their 70s and their 90s, respectively. And social care is one of your success of five giants, five ideas. The housing market is something that has to be addressed in this post-COVID settlement, isn't it?
It certainly does. And of course, the first order problem is building sufficient housing to take care of our people. Unless you can do that, really, all sorts of other things don't become as possible as they should be. It's fascinating, actually, the way Farhan has woven all the questions like that into the big picture of the discipline of social anthropology. And I thought, if I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, that there's an intriguing symmetry between bringing the study of social anthropology home, the British Empire coming home again. Because when I was young, and I read a bit of social anthropology out of sort of private interest, it was all about cockfights in Bali. And now, the young and bright social anthropologists who are going to make the pace for the subject in the decades to come are going to do, I'm sure, what Farhan did, and go and live for 16 months on the Caldwell estate or an equivalent in Kilburn. It's absolutely fascinating to see it.
Well, you've mentioned generations, which I'm afraid you've opened me up to asking this, not to incite a generational war, but the housing problem is to some extent a generational one, right? Which is, if that we build more houses, the houses that are currently owned predominantly by older Britons do not become an appreciating asset class in the way that they have, that has made people feel richer and more secure. There are going to be losers from your post-COVID settlement.
Yes, I suppose there are, really. There always are, in relative terms, losers. But the one thing about technological improvements, which we've, the scientific wing of the Enlightenment, really, ensured that you can have a genuinely rising level of GDP per head and so on, that improves a lot of everybody. But it's the relativities within it. It's those that get left behind. We're very concerned as a society, quite rightly, with both areas and categories of society who are left behind by the rising tide of affluence. And that's been a theme right across the post-war period. And that we became a much more unequal society in the 1980s than we had been before. The inequality levels, the relative inequalities, had been narrowing quite noticeably until 79, and then they all opened up again, and we have to pay attention to that. And it puts me in mind of another book I've been reading lately with great interest, Ben Fenton's book called To Be Fair. And his question is, what is best done cooperatively and what is best left to an individual sense of competition? Well, and we have to rebalance that. And I think Farhan's book is very much about that.
Well, that's why I want to bring you back to you, Farhan, because one of the things that you've written about in this book that I think speaks to the other two guests is the idea of public spaces and who owns public space. And actually, do we have an investment in our public realm that means that people in parks and libraries? I mean, if COVID did anything, it made me appreciate my local park, my only source of fun for some months. What did you learn from your research about the value of public spaces?
Well, yeah, public spaces and community spaces as well, right? So those spaces where togetherness is sort of not just incidental, but designed in some ways and held together. And I think there's something in here that actually really speaks to the challenge you raised to Peter about, you know, winners and losers, because we're not always these calculating people in our day-to-day lives, you know? If you look at climate change, for instance, one of the most compelling ways to get people to care about climate change is to talk about their grandchildren, right? And if there's a prospect that we might have to give up a certain standard of, you know, whatever it is within our lives that we're attached to, thinking about not just future generations in the abstract, but your future attachments, your grandchildren, becomes a really compelling way of getting people to sort of, you know, want to take on those costs and not always think about, you know, does the balance sheet work out in my favor? And when you look at community groups, you can kind of see an extension of that logic, right? People sort of change their calculus. And the basis of valuing policy, the basis of valuing others, the basis of valuing all these sorts of things shifts from this kind of calculative sort of reason to sort of more open-ended kind of, you know, at one point in the book, I sort of referred to this as political love, which is sort of, you know, this idea of what can we be together rather than what's in it for me.
Which is the same as the appeal to young people who are relatively unlikely to die from COVID, that you want to stay at home to protect your granny, right? Granny and granddad.
Well, exactly. I mean, so I think we do have this great capacity for political love, you know, but we're not sort of set up to tap into it as a force. And that's not just tragic, but actually a real issue, because so many of the challenges we face actually require that sort of coming together and that sort of way of valuing one another that isn't just calculative.
I'm going to give you a magic wand, Farhan. One concrete change you could make. What would it be?
I'd really struggle to say, but just one, you know, really considerable upping of the investment in day-to-day communities, in these sorts of venues for coming together, you know, in everyday community groups. You know, with David Cameron, we had sort of quote unquote the big society, but that was sort of coupled with actually pulling the rug out from under these groups in terms of formal funding. And so it's sort of an informalization of this, but actually you do need that formal infrastructure to hold together community groups, right? That's kind of what the story of Paddy and Daisy is showing.
Well, that's all that we have time for today. Three great items with lots to tell us about the future. Thank you to all my guests. Peter Hennessy's A Duty of Care, Britain Before and After COVID, is out later this week. Farhan Samanani's How to Live with Each Other is published on the 24th of March. And Post-War Modern New Art in Britain, 1945 to 1965, curated by Jane Allison, opens at the Barbican on Thursday until the end of June. Many thanks to today's studio engineer, Tim Heffer. Next week, Kirsty Walk discusses artistic rivalries and collaborations. But for now, thank you and goodbye. Thank you for listening to this edition of Start the Week on BBC Radio 4, produced by Katie Hickman. And if you're after more conversations around culture, science, politics and history, there are many more programmes to listen to on the Start the Week website and BBC Sounds.